Hello, this is Scott Besnecker, and you're listening to Voices from the Center. This is episode 4 of our podcast, and today we're talking about schizophrenia. Schizophrenia affects about 1% of the American population, and when I moved to Madison at 21, I met Cheryl. Cheryl was maybe 10 years older and the daughter of our small group leader, and Cheryl was struggling with schizophrenia. And I've learned to really appreciate Cheryl, the kind of perspective she brings to life. She's been in and out of institutions, and I do remember visiting her earlier on with my wife, Janine. And there was something about Cheryl and her intelligence and her thoughtfulness that just drew us. Every time Cheryl gets up to share at our church, Faith Community Bible Church, she always has something profound to say. And I thought it'd be interesting just to talk to Cheryl and have her chat a bit about her 40-year journey with schizophrenia. There are a number of elements that played into it, and I'll let her tell the story. I think you'll see something of the compassion and intelligence of Cheryl as she describes to us what it's like to live with schizophrenia.
Well, I was the daughter of missionaries, which meant that I spent my childhood and my formative years in another country, Honduras and Latin America. I came to the United States for high school, had a pretty average high school experience. The summer after I graduated, however, I crashed. And that was the beginning of what I call 40 years in the wilderness. For me.
What did crashing look like as an 18-year-old and getting out of high school?
Crashing, in my case, I went to a party in Northern California with some cousins. I was 18. I had a relationship with a cousin, a male cousin, and one of the things that happened was that he took me to a movie, speaking of movies, Scott, not unfortunately a Ben-Hur movie, it was Rosemary's Baby, if you remember that movie.
I don't think I've seen it, but it's a horror film, right?
It's a horror film, and it had its effect on me, plus just adolescent issues coming up, plus my family left me in Northern California to go back to Honduras. And I was en route to college, and I never got there. I went back to the party. I came home from a party one night and stayed up all night in bed, thumbing through my Bible page by page. Woke up the next morning, disrobed, and walked around my uncle and aunt's house just out of it.
And was it that night that you'd gone to Rosemary's Baby?
No, Rosemary's Baby happened maybe 2 weeks prior. It did something. It did something to me. I guess it's debatable. Sometimes I wonder if mental illness is not modern demon possession. I don't know. But there definitely is a demonic, an evil, fearful thing that happens in the minds of those of us who've suffered mental illness.
And something in watching that horror film triggered something, and within a couple of weeks, you had kind of lost touch with reality?
Exactly. Exactly, yeah. Losing touch with reality, that's what it is, yeah. And you talk about voices, Scott. Voices are a very real part of mental illness. My mental illness, hearing voices telling me to do things and things that are irrational and losing discretion and not being able to understand, distinguish between voices that are real and good and voices that are not. Certainly hearing the voice of God is one thing, but there are other voices out there. I had my voices, and some of them came from Honduras. Some of them came from high school in Colorado. Some of them came from this wild party in the Bay Area. and it all came out in the wash. You know, and this party happened in the late 60s when LSD was on the market, and I was very naive, and I wandered around this million-dollar home in the Bay Area, and I would pick up a glass of soda and drink it indiscriminately, and there was a seance going on in the living room, and I was just sort of wanting to relate. When you're a missionary kid, you have to relate. Whether you're in another country, they're different. When you're in the U.S., they're different. And here you are. Who am I? Am I Honduran? Am I American? Whatever it is, I want to relate to whoever I'm with. And at the party, I wanted to relate.
But walk us through those years of kind of waking up out of touch with reality and coming to terms with the fact that you've had some kind of mental breakdown.
I have, and one of my earliest memories was being at a Christian camp when I was in junior high, and a young girl got up and with her sisters sang, and I was very attracted to her as a person, and she had pulled out of a nervous breakdown. And I remember that, and I remember reading Life magazine in Colorado, my grandmother's home, an article about a schizophrenic. And I remember when I read that article, I had no idea of my own problems, but I read that article and my hands just sweat. And I thought, oh my goodness, this would be a terrible thing to happen to a person. And it happened. And
you're like 12 or something when you're reading this article, thinking, man, I'm glad that's not me.
Yeah, that's right. And it happened. It's interesting because my early conception of mental illness was the nervous breakdown thing. And in reality, my mental illness has been a long-term mental illness. It wasn't just a one-time thing. And I had repeated crashes in my 20s, in my 30s. And
but you'd go for periods very much yourself and in touch with reality, and you didn't really manifest any kind of mental illness. And then all of a sudden, things would fall apart and you'd lose touch.
That's right. I did manage to leave home in my early 20s and move to Fresno, California. And I somehow managed to go to college and get a degree and get a teaching credential. And in one of my crashes, I ended up in Los Angeles. Interesting, my parents were with InterVarsity, who you're familiar with. And we were at Catalina Island on a family vacation with InterVarsity, and I freaked out, lost my cookies or my reality, and ended up staying in Los Angeles and pulling out of it and getting a teaching job, a bilingual teaching job.
And how long was that period where you sort of had lost touch? Is it like a week or a month?
Oh, my goodness. It peaked for a week, and then I got psychiatric care in a hospital, and it took about a month to completely normalize and get back on my feet again. But I did so, and within 2 months, I interviewed for a teaching job in L.A. and was hired.
Did you feel like, I'm finally done with mental illness, it's over, I can move on with life now?
Yeah, I think I always felt that way. I always felt like, well, this will go away and I'll get over it, I'll be okay. Consequently, I would not put myself in the bracket of people who are suicidal. That just simply did not happen for me. And I like to think that it had something to do with growing up in Honduras. In spite of my teenage issues, I felt very loved in Honduras. I love the Honduran people. I did not feel like there was a tough competitive thing there, as in the U.S., for example. I felt very accepted, very loved for all the right reasons, and I was surrounded by people. People were very important in our life as missionaries. We were a people family, and as long as there were people around, I was happy.
Hmm.
And so even in my psych experiences, going into psych wards, which I did in L.A. as a school teacher, I was interviewed by this Conrad principal in East L.A., and he liked me. And yet, every year, I'd check into the hospital, and he kept my job for me.
Hmm.
And
you'd check yourself in, because you
well,
knew.
Yeah, pretty much it was a mutual agreement between me and my doctor. I would lose reality, and my significant others or people around, family members would, you know,
confirm that
I needed a hospitalization. I should check into the hospital. And it would be another week or two or three before I pulled out of it and started over again. But the people aspect, even in psych wards, psych wards are full of people. And my job, of course, meant I was around people. And as long as there were people, I had hope. And, yeah.
And were there themes that traced through the breakdowns that were they predictable and like, oh, yeah. This happens all the time.
I would say it was pretty predictable. Like I mentioned earlier, my first crash, I was 18 and my cousin was 19, and he and I hit it off. And I was, looking back, I call it immaturity on my part. It's just that I couldn't deal. Every time a relationship would come up on the horizon with some guy, I couldn't deal with it. I just couldn't.
So it's often male relationships
male
that triggered.
Male relationships drove me every time. It was almost a sure bet. Every time, you know, I started out with a date, two or three dates, and then I was gone.
Huh. And how do you interpret that 40 years later as you're kind of looking back on this theme of, yeah, I start to get close to a guy, and some switch is flipped, and I have a breakdown.
Yeah, yeah.
Or maybe you don't have an interpretation for sort of what's involved there.
I still don't have an interpretation, Scott. I just, you know, the whole idea that even Jesus heals people. Some of them are instantaneous, but some of them are long-term. And it, time, you know, sometimes there are no immediate answers. But over 40 years, I'm in a place now where I'm very comfortable with relationships. Practically speaking, I look at relationships as friendships more than the chemistry thing, you know. Chemistry does not work for me very well. If I can keep a friendship going platonically, I am really good. And as a Christian, I've learned to be content with whatever God has put in my life.
Hmm.
And this contentment is very sane. It's a sane way to go, to be content. So
you go through these years as a teacher in L.A., almost yearly, having a breakdown that gets corrected after, what, a week to a month sort of range, being able to go back to school.
Mm.
At some point, you come to Madison.
Yeah.
What was your journey from L.A. to Madison both?
My journey from L.A. to Madison, I was in L.A. I was in a vineyard church, a strong charismatic movement. And there was, among many other fascinating people, UCLA students and the likes, there was this guy who was a missionary son from South Africa, the bearded wonder type of guy. He played the piano, really artistic fellow, and very godly Christian, and very single, and very eligible, and maybe I shook his hand twice and moved right into my fantasy world as usual. But I thought, this time I'm not going to talk about it. I had talked my way through so many other relationships and hospitalizations, and this one was so important to me that I thought, you know, I figured out in my own little head, if I don't talk about it, then it'll be a reality. So I'm not going to talk. And I refused to talk. And I didn't get away with it. I ended up losing my teaching job, coming back home to Northern California. My parents just dragged me all over to doctors and psychiatrists. We tried lithium. We tried everything. And the whole time, I knew what I was doing, but I wasn't going to talk about it. My poor parents didn't know what to do. The psychiatrist didn't know what to do. And I held on. I wasn't going to talk. So my father's job with InterVarsity moved him out to Madison, and I did somehow have a teaching offer in California, but I thought, no. My family's moving. I'm going to move with them. I did value my family enough, so I came with them to Madison, and still not talking and out of reality in my head, but not talking. So nobody knew a whole lot about what was going on.
So you could be engaged with this world and sort of dupe people into thinking you're very much rooted, but in your head, you're not. I mean, you knew how to play the I'm out here in the stratosphere in my head, but in reality, I can engage with people, and they won't really know that mentally I'm in another place.
That's right. That's exactly the way it was. Yeah. So I did get a substitute teaching job in Madison for about a year there, and then I lost it. It caught up with me, and I ended up in the hospital. And again, I still wasn't going to talk, but my behavior was, I was breaking down. I wasn't able to keep up that whatever
facade.
I just broke under it. And I went into the hospital, but I still would not talk. And the psychiatrist said, well, you know, we're going to have to send your daughter to the, in my mom's words, the poorhouse. So they did. They put me in Mendota. I mean, well, Mendota was one, and then Badger Prairie, and I was there for 8 years.
In Badger Prairie or Mendota?
In Badger Prairie. And I was 6 months in Mendota, and then 8 years in Badger Prairie. And still holding on to my fantasy and not talking about it, but living it out. Living it out, creating my own world and living in it. Didn't matter where you put me, if I was at home with my parents or if I was in the hospital, in my room or in the day room smoking or in the wherever I was, I had my little world with me. It was not a life, Scott. It was 8 years of not living.
Well,
you know, it was.
And you don't feel like your time in Badger Prairie was as helpful in giving you the grounding you needed to sort of move on, or were there things that really were helpful?
No, I think it was the best. It was no life, but it was the best thing that ever happened to me. I think I needed a break. I needed a time, extended time, where I didn't have to think about it or process it or do anything about it. There was no pressure to do anything. It's kind of funny, but what I do remember is that they would come out to the day room with this box, with all these little boxes with people's names, and they'd hand out cigarettes. So I would take a cigarette, and I learned to smoke. So for 8 years, I smoked. It was the nicest thing I've ever done.
Helped you to calm down a little bit, huh?
It did. The nicotine, you know, checked in, and it was just, it did become a world within a world. It became another Honduras, Badger Prairie. All the other folks that were there, you know, the same stuff. One lady was minus an arm, and she spoke French. And there was this kid that was in his early 20s and just kind of a rascal Oliver Twist type of kid. And I these people are still in my head. And while I was in Badger Prairie, these people accepted me. We accepted each other. This is all we had. Mm. We were a poverty-stricken Latin American country in the U.S. We had nothing to do but be together and take care of each other.
Mm. And so in your mind, you were in Honduras, and these people were in Honduras with you, and you were in community with them, and you loved and accepted one another. And there were threads of that that were real, like some of the people were actually real, but the circumstances around them you had created in your head.
Yeah, there was a lot of unreal in the middle of it. And you know, another facet of this too was my Christianity. You know, my fantasy was that I was the bride of Jesus. And this happens, you know, you talk to anybody who's been in a psych ward,
there's a religious
there's
component.
Always a Jesus figure. Uh-huh. You know, they think they're Jesus, or they think that person's Jesus, or, you know, it's, and I thought I was the bride of Jesus Christ, and I had my Bible all interpreted and fit into my fantasy package. And one thing I did, I was convinced that if I didn't evangelize, and this is a recurring dream I still have, that if I don't evangelize the world within the next 2 hours, we're all going to go to hell. But if I do evangelize the world, I get what I want. I'll get Jesus, Jesus being the male figure. So that's where I was at. So I would be in the day room, and the voices would come and say, okay, Cheryl, get ready. 1, 2, 3, go. And I would get down on my knees and put my hands up and shout in the middle of the day room.
You have
shout.
2 hours.
Yeah, I have
and
2 hours.
The clock is ticking.
And the world either goes to hell or goes to Christ. So I would shout, Jesus Christ is Lord of Lords and King of Kings to the glory of God the Father. I was in the supermarket about a month ago, and this guy that was in Badger Prairie, then he's out, and he's still crazy, Mark. Scott, some of us are always going to be crazy, and he's still crazy. But he says, you know, Cheryl, he says, I remember you, Cheryl. He says, you're the one who told me about Jesus.
So there was some effect in that.
There was some effect, yeah. But anyway, that's kind of a funny thing. But
A couple of questions. One, I'm not trying to play into mental illness here, but if your mental illness were a person, because I just feel like sometimes we need to see things from a different angle. If your mental illness, if schizophrenia was a person, how would you describe your relationship with that person?
Well, you know, that's funny. The first word that comes to my mind is flirtatious. I think I flirt with mental illness, you know.
There's some kind of attraction there.
There is, yeah. Mentally ill people are really, well, depending on where you catch them, what stage you're in, mentally ill people can be very happy people because they're getting what they want in their own way, you know, and, the wages of sin is death. You know, there's got to be a morning after.
And there are consequences to flirting with schizophrenia.
That's right, yeah.
What is it that we miss by not having deep relationships with people who have schizophrenia?
Well, you know, I have been at FCBC for over 20 years now. And I'll sit in Sunday school, and there will be students in the class, and then there'll be a couple of married folk, and then myself. And I love our class, because I love to discuss. And I notice what the students share in contrast to what I share, and I think, you know what? You're boring. You are so boring. I know you're stable, and you're okay, and you have student loans, and you're making it, but you're boring. You will not, if you know someone with mental illness, they are not boring.
there's a certain zest to life that gets added when you're in a relationship with someone with mental illness.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, I grew up in a Baptist church, and I can remember the whole goal of my, before mental illness even was on the horizon, my whole passion was, as a Christian, I just don't want Christianity to be boring. So I set out to make it not boring. It's happened, but you know the old saying, a schizophrenic person, if you know someone with schizophrenia, they know things that you don't know. Huh. It's like the Native American thing or the African American, you know, different folks know things that you don't know. And, you know,
it's interesting what I hear you saying sort of is that there's a kind of reality that those who are out of touch with reality are in touch with, that those of us who are so-called in touch with reality are blind to, or don't like to look at, or I don't know what it is, but like there's a way in which I feel like as we've interacted over the 30 years and in church, that I feel like you're grounded and in touch with a kind of reality and a kind of community that feels so foreign to me. And there's a, oddly enough, there's a kind of reality that you have, a kind of groundedness that you have, that I live in a kind of fantasy world where schizophrenics don't exist, you know? And so it's interesting that you say that getting to know schizophrenic people adds a kind of zest to life, and there's a kind of perspective on life, like with other minority communities, that the majority community miss out on.
Mm-hmm. It comes at a cost. I mean, you know, it's like getting a PhD. You have to write a thesis, you know. If you're going to, if God put schizophrenia on your chart, then you have to live it out. You have to live with it and, you know, overcome it to some. You have to control it, not let it control you. You know, but
any advice for folk for whom there's a family member or a friend that struggles with schizophrenia?
I wish I knew what to say on that one, Scott, because I have a neighbor lady who I love with a passion, who is currently somewhere. I don't know what psych ward she's in, or if she's on the streets, or in jail, or where she is at the at this time, as we speak, and so suicidal and so desperate. And I know her family, her mother, her sister, are totally distraught, and we, her friends, are distraught, and she is distraught. And I don't mean to sound pedantic, but I believe Jesus is the answer. I don't care if you're schizophrenic or a UCLA grad or working your way through a marriage. If Jesus isn't the answer, then we should all jump off the ship. I mean, that's how I feel.
Interesting.
That's just how I feel. But, you know, Jesus is the answer, but how to access Jesus when your mind is so confused and your emotions are distraught and your chemistry is wacko? Sometimes it takes medication. Frankly, with Diane, my friend, I think, well, you know, I wish I had been there the other night to help her, but I wasn't. So I couldn't keep her out of the hospital. I couldn't get her into the hospital because she wouldn't go. And I couldn't keep her out of it either. So there, where are you? Well, hopefully she's in a hospital. And sometimes hospitals, that's what they're there for, you know. Maybe that's a good place for her right now, to be in a hospital. The staff are probably not Christians, but they're good people, and they're kind, and they're intelligent and skilled, and, you know. Maybe your sibling or your child needs a hospitalization, and it's okay.
Inpatient program is not the end of the world.
Certainly not, especially now. You know, nobody ever goes for 8 years like I did, but, you know, 2 or 3 days maybe, and,
Well, really, really helpful, Cheryl. I appreciate this window on a world that exists that we often insulate ourselves from. And I think granting some dignity and humanity to folks struggling with mental illness, particularly schizophrenia, is a gift that you've given. So I'm grateful for your voice and your contribution.
Well, thank you, Scott.
When Mother Teresa came to San Francisco, she said she encountered a kind of poverty that she hadn't encountered in Kolkata. It was a poverty of loneliness and alienation in the homeless, mentally ill community. And she liked to talk about people who are excluded, people who are desperately poor, as a picture of Jesus in distressing disguise. And so I was in San Francisco a number of years ago and thought, you know, I'd love to have a meal with Jesus in distressing disguise. So I went to a local McDonald's. There's a guy standing in line. He was wearing ragged clothes, had long hair and a beard. I thought, this guy looks kind of like Jesus. He went up to the counter and said, I'll just have a glass of water. I realized he was homeless. I came up and said, would you like something else? He said, sure. So we ordered a meal, sat down, and one of the first things that Bill said to me was, the foxes have holes and the birds have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. You know, I'm a little bit like Jesus. I thought, oh my gosh, I think I'm having dinner with Jesus here. And as I got to know Bill, I got to know that he struggled with schizophrenia. And that schizophrenia had alienated him from his family. We went around trying to find a local homeless shelter for him to spend the night in. He said that sometimes he would just steal food in order to get into jail so that he could have a warm place to sleep. So as we were looking for a place and someone gave us directions and they weren't good directions, he went off and he entered his other world. And they always do that. They're always giving me the wrong directions or trying to lead me astray. And I could see quite easily how Bill would have a difficult time being accepted into virtually any community in those periods where he just went off. And yet I've gotten to know over the years, probably have three folk I'm fairly close to who struggle with schizophrenia. And I realize there is something I see of Christ there. There's often a really strict view of humanity, a cold honesty that they give as they speak. And it's sometimes couched in and mixed in with things that aren't true. And you've got to kind of sift through what they're saying. But there's often a real clarity sometimes in what they're saying, how they view life and different aspects of it. And I've got to believe that the folks struggling with schizophrenia, probably the worst thing that we could do is bunch them all together in a place so that they live in one place together rather than being rooted in the larger community. And I think there are things that we can learn from folk who are walking that journey of sorting out reality, things that they have to contribute, and things we have to contribute to them. So I want to urge us as we think about the folk who are struggling with mental illness, particularly schizophrenia, in our lives, in our families, to reach out, to embrace, to figure out what it looks like to be in some kind of community together that we might walk this journey and both perhaps be a little more stabilized as a result. Appreciate you listening in. And I appreciate Cheryl and her honesty and her sharing her story with us. Thankful for what she has to contribute. Thankful for my church, who welcomes a number of folk who struggle with mental illness and the things that we learn from our friends on the margins, whom I believe are in the center. And so you've been listening to Voices from the Center. I look forward to having you join us again.